I'd like now to welcome to the program Noam Freshman and Elena Gvilia. They are students at St. John's College, and they are doing a project called Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having.
So, Georgia, we're not talking about the state. We're talking about the former Soviet Republic.
Yeah, so the Republic of Georgia is a small country located crossroad between Asia and Europe. And what can I say about Georgia? It's a really small, beautiful country with old traditions, a long and intense history.
Which is where you're from, by the way.
Yes, yes, which I'm from. And the country, to give some ideas about the country, this is the place where word medicine comes from because of Medea, mythological Medea. So Jason with Argonauts traveled to Medea, to Georgia, called Kolchetti, the kingdom of Kolchetti at that time, to get golden fleece. And this is also a place to be considered the cradle of wine. So we
have the cradle of wine?
Yes. So we have this 5,000 years old tradition of winemaking, which is still used in Georgia to make wine. So these two things kind of makes the Georgia unique place to go and visit. Georgia is beautiful in its own ways because the Caucasian mountain, it's also bounded with the Black Sea to the west. So we have this mixture mountain and sea together, which makes it really attractive to people. But the history has been really cruel because its strategic location, it always was someone under someone's desire. So it was always it has been struggling so many wars, and no, in spite of that, the beauty of Georgia is that country and people of people in Georgia maintained its nationality, sense of nationality, really strongly. And people still try to be independent, have their own history really untouched by others. And language is really unique because it's not spoken in any other countries. And we have our own alphabet, which is one of the 14 live alphabets in the world.
Really? Is it different alphabet than any other?
Absolutely different, yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So what language or languages did you grow up speaking?
Georgian.
You grew up speaking Georgian. And was there any Russian left over by the time you...
We still were taught Russian at schools. And I've been raised learning Russian, but the native language is Georgian. Even though the history and the background was really harsh for Georgians, people always had this strong sense of nationality, and that's what they always wanted to protect. And the current history is kind of the last 15 years. We had two wars. The one war was 3-4 years ago between Russia and Georgian, and I was there, and it was the time when I was in my 17th, and I was not just only escaping from home or hiding from open war. It was that I needed answers on the questions, and no one gave me answer because I was just a little girl who doesn't have a right to have answers or something like that. And I decided to take a responsibility in future of Georgia to a better future of Georgia. And in future, I might be able to be the person who give the answers to these questions.
So how old were you?
I'm 20 right now.
You're 20 now, but when you were starting to ask these questions, you were 17 years old. And so what were the questions you were asking at that time?
The question was, is any different way that we can solve this unfinished conflict between Georgians and Russians, and also the influence the Russians have right now on Georgians is unbelievably high, because the previous war between the Russian and Georgian war happened. It was in 1993, which was broke up between Georgian and one of the separate part of Georgia. But it was absolutely forced and supported by Russian. So they supported the separate part of Georgia with weapons, with the moral encouragement, and, you know, everything. And it turned out that the war broke up between people who used to be the same people for 18th centuries. And now they're fighting each other because of these strangers.
Right.
And they end up, we end up losing the part of the Georgia, which is called Abkhazeti. And people were promised to have this beautiful independence.
Right.
And they will have beautiful life, independent life. But it ended up that Russian demanded them to have Russian passports, or if they don't accept Russian citizenship, they should leave territory. So that's why right now we have almost 300,000 refugees in Georgia.
So a lot of people chose to leave.
Yes, yes. And that a lot of people were forced to leave because of the war, and they left their houses, they left their families. And there was it was really terrible thing for Georgians, because one of the most important thing for us is our families, our relatives, and how they feel, how they live. And right now we don't know what is going on there.
Because you can't go back and forth.
No, there's
no way.
Now,
these are people who spoke Georgian language with your special alphabet and Georgian traditions, winemaking, everything else that you were just talking about.
Yes.
And they're... essentially artificially separated.
Yes. I mean, there were people who wanted to be, but as I mentioned, the separate part of Georgia. But people would not ever do this without the huge support of Russia. And it was artificially broken up. I mean, the conflict was artificially broken up between Georgian and Abkhazian.
And the region that Elena is talking about, that went through this civil war during the collapse of the former USSR, many of the refugees had to leave because there was an ethnic cleansing campaign. So there were over 15,000 people killed in Abkhazia, and that's part of the reason that there are these refugee camps in Georgia proper and not in this de facto region called Abkhazia. And that's part of the reason why we're going, because of this conflict.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, that is the reason why we're going.
So, so, ladies and gentlemen, these young people are going to this area, what, this summer?
Yes. This summer, yeah. In what, a month, right?
Exactly.
So, what are you going to do there?
The project, as long as I've heard about the opportunity to get funded for the project, which is kind of focused on the peacemaking, conflict resolution, I kind of felt that it's my first chance to start my action towards the final goal that I have. And the project we wrote was the proposal we submitted for the grant, and the grant is $10,000. So Davis Foundation every year gives $10,000 to 100 grants, 100 proposals across the U.S., and one of the grants goes to St. John's College. And
there was a competition within our school on both campuses, because St. John's is in Santa Fe here
and
also in Annapolis, right? And so the Davis Foundation really, we were sponsored by St. John's, and we won this scholarship through St. John's sponsorship, but then through the foundation, which, like Elena said, gives $10,000 grants to schools around the country.
So what are you actually, who's going, how many people are going, what are you going to do when you get there?
So as we mentioned, the name of the project is the Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia.
Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia.
So which sounds kind of...
It's beautiful.
Yeah, this is the metaphor we choose for the project. Since we have these three different parts of these, three different stages of the project. The first stage is the educational stage, which will take 2 weeks, and we are trying to implant the system of education which we have at St. John's College. So the curriculum, kind of liberal arts, a great books program. So 2 weeks education, twice in a week we will have seminar on the Oresteia, since it's all about the revenge and the coming to the bring the revenge to end.
Right.
And then we'll have once in a week the conflict resolution training, and once in a week the history classes and discussions. So this...
Yeah, so just to expand a little bit on what Elena is saying, is that during this education portion, we'll be taking 20 high school students 10 from Georgia proper, and then 10 from Abkhazia, which is this which has this de facto government as we were speaking of. And so what this educational portion of the project really is meant to do is bring these high school students who wouldn't normally have a chance to come and talk to each other, to bring them to the table and talk about this incredible work by Aeschylus that really deals with a seemingly unstoppable cycle of revenge.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And we're really using it as a platform to talk about these larger issues. Yeah.
Why did Aeschylus write this stuff? You know, to be studied in seminar and go home? No, it's to be used.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly, in real life.
Yeah.
And the main point of this, the kind of, we try to inspire and educate 20 high school students of Georgia, specifically people whose parents fought to each other.
Yeah.
And now they are at the same table and discussing this conflict instead of fighting each other. This is the kind of main target for us to aim. And that we want to eventually start talking about the conflict instead of fighting to each other. Mm-hmm. And these 20 students will inspire other students who are surrounded with them, and this will spread the word around them, and this will eventually give us the much huger outcome than we kind of will have with the 20 students only. And the history classes are kind of designed for, because we didn't mention that the in Abkhazia they altered the manuals of history. So they made up the new history manuals. And so we have two different versions of history, happened during the wars. So now we bring these people together, we bring these two different variation of history manuals, and we will start discussing both of them. And we will not decide that one of these is right and one is wrong. We will start comparing to each other, and we will start discussing how they work and what is the truth, where we should start with. Or maybe we have to forget about the past and start new future together. Mm-hmm. Without any conflict. And this will be the first stage of the project, planting the tree of peace in Georgia.
Now, who's teaching this?
So two of us and the rest of the team.
Two St. John students.
Right, yes. There are two other team members. Terrence Manning, who is a graduate in the Graduate Institute. And then Bilsana Bibic, who's from Montenegro, actually. So we're really kind of a group from all over the place. Yeah. But I think what really ties us here is Santa Fe. And
what language will all this be in?
We will use English because it was intentionally chosen because we need the neutral
neutral language.
Language,
right.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And we'll use English over there.
Can you maybe talk about the St. John's method a little bit? Because I think it's such an unusual
Sure.
way of teaching and thinking that kind of, in my experience, I mean, having gone there a gazillion years ago and the Graduate Institute, but still it slows down the mind a little bit in a way that can be very positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, St. John's is a liberal arts program, really at its core. And basically what students do is all of the classes are in the Socratic method. All of the classes are around tables, and tutors sit at the very ends and aren't professing. They're tutors. They're really there to you know, help us through the process and think through the process of learning with mm-hmm. us. And so really we're trying to take that method of, you know, the Socratic method and really teaching through a self-discovery to Georgia, because we think, you know, liberal arts, I think, can sound kind of elitist, to be honest. But
which is a totally overused accusation, in my humble opinion. But anyway.
Well, you know, and as a St. John's student, I would agree. If you break it down, liberal arts is really just about, you know, a liberation of the mind, and so I think. You know, studying the Oresteia and bringing it to students and bringing this method to Georgians will be really, I think what we're really trying to do is just make them ambassadors and make them humanitarians, you know.
I would add, I mean, every Johnny would agree as that the St. John's method is all about questioning, mm-hmm. and that's what we want to start there. Since the questioning is not that important thing right now in Georgia, and especially with these young people, if we don't start questioning what is going on and how it how all this happened, mm-hmm. and what we have to do in future, the answers would never come to us.
Right.
So, as I mentioned, no one gave me the answer to the question, and the questions still exist in me, and I'm still seeking the answers to these questions. And what I'm trying is to bring people with me and trying to figure out answers with those people and people back home, and sit at the same table together and eventually reach the closest possible point to the answer if there is no final answers to these questions.
Well, and this method of questioning, and you know, you sit around the table and you address each other by their last name, Mr. Freshman, and so on. It sets up a kind of situation of equality and respect,
exactly.
where it's a kind of non-hierarchical, respectful. Mm-hmm. Even the teachers don't really know the answers. But I mean, when you think about the questions in Georgia, they're the same questions that we've been dealing with for millennia, which is how do we deal with conflicts over borders, territories, right. resources, governments, and things like that in a way that doesn't involve killing people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, exactly. And you mentioned the sense of equality, and it's really important for us because I'm trying to keep myself really kind of far from the teaching process and be kind of busy with organization because I don't want to make people feel that there is someone who can be biased. So there will be two different people for two different sides, and we will have neutral language, and we will have people who are not at all connected to Georgia in terms of that how I am connected to Georgia.
Right, so don't have a whole bunch of baggage about
exactly.
who got hurt in their family
exactly.
or something.
Yeah. That's what we want to finally to have this kind of really clear base, clean base to start new motion in Georgia and to figure out the new way to the peaceful path, I guess, to peaceful Georgia.
And now, you had a fundraising event not too long mm-hmm. ago, which was successful. You still need to raise a few more bucks to get
correct.
Everybody over there
yes.
on the airplane and get them back.
Yes.
And you have a website which can be found easily by Googling the words Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
It's peaceforgeorgia.weebly.com. Weebly is W-E-E-B-L-Y. But if you just Google Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia. And how much more do you need in order to get there?
About $2,000. We actually, a really generous donor has offered to donate $500 if we find someone to match it.
Ah, nice.
So that's something. We have more information about that on our website, and we have our full proposal on our website.
So if our gentle listeners out in Radio Land collectively put together $500 that
yeah.
your donor will match it?
Exactly,
yes.
Yeah. And just to, you know, the Davis Foundation grant, we, you know, that was incredible to receive and really quite an honor, actually. But the price of getting to Georgia is virtually the cost of the grant.
Right.
So in terms of, we're going to be going to refugee camps also and bringing these students to refugee camps. And
so you need
holding
to
health
do
clinics.
Things like eat when you get there and
eat
so on.
And buy medical mm-hmm. supplies and educational
right.
supplies. And
well, you didn't mention the second very really important part of this project is the medical mission. So after the educational part, we will bring 20 students to refugee camps, and we will, with the help of these 20 students and 10 volunteer doctors who are volunteering for this project, we will try to kind of give some medical support, medical treatment to the refugee camps. So those 20 students will see the real, the actual outcome of the war. How can people be victim of the wars? How can their lives be damaged? And they will, right now when they're few years ago their parents were fighting each other, now they are helping to each other. And this for that we will need the medical supplies, which is really expensive, and
mm-hmm.
we are hoping that our fundraising goes better, even better it used to go.
we raised like Elena was saying, our Georgia night was very successful, but we still got a little bit to go.
Well, so, ladies and gentlemen, take note, and once again, you can Google Planting the Tree of Peace in Georgia. Noam Freshman and Elena Gvilia are students at St. John's College, peaceforgeorgia.weebly.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for everyone for listening to us.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Doyle Preheim. He is the musical director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale, which is having a big concert this weekend. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be with you. Yes, we are having a big concert. It's the final concert of our season, and it's the final concert for myself as musical director and my wife, Mary Jo, who's been the accompanist for the choir these past 8 years.
So what will you be playing?
Well, the choir is performing one of the great masterworks of choral literature, the Brahms Requiem. What's a bit different about this performance is that we're doing it with piano accompaniment, and we're doing it with a choir of only 48 singers rather than a large choir of 120.
Which 48 sounds pretty big, too.
Well, it is, but when you're singing with a full symphony orchestra, and this work calls for a full complement of instruments, you really need 100 to 120 voices to balance the orchestra. So it's half that size, and so we're doing it with piano. And we're doing it in the English translation rather than in the original German.
Really? That's interesting.
And
how'd you choose that?
Well, it was, I guess, two reasons. One is it takes a lot of rehearsal time to teach the German to acquire. But more importantly, Brahms wrote the work in German so that the people in the pews in the audience could understand the words.
Right, as opposed to writing in Latin or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so rather than doing it in German, we said, let's do it in English so everyone can understand what we're singing about.
Is it a good translation?
It's a very good translation. You know, translations can always be problematic. They're not exact literal translations.
Yeah.
And sometimes one vowel on the English word is more difficult to sing than it would be in the original German,
right.
That sort of thing. But it's a wonderful translation, and the text is so powerful.
If you're translating choral music, you're all about vowels, basically.
Your vowels are very important. You don't want to sing an E sound on a very high note. You want to sing an ah or an
O. Because it could pierce holes in the eardrums of
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And so this is a piece that was recently done by the Santa Fe Symphony.
Santa Fe Symphony did it just 2 weeks ago. A beautiful performance in German with a full orchestra. Ours will be much more of a chamber music performance than theirs was, because we have smaller forces and we're doing it with piano. So if anyone heard the symphony orchestra and chorus performance, if they want a different experience, come hear ours next weekend.
It is interesting to hear the same piece twice in two different interpretations or two different types of performances. It's, I think, really instructive and often fun for audiences.
Well, I think it is. And a different venue. They did it in the concert hall. We were going to be doing it in churches with somewhat more live acoustics.
Where will you be?
Well, our Los Alamos concert on Saturday evening, May the 12th. At 7 o'clock is going to be at the United Church on Canyon Road. And then our Sunday concert, 2:30 in the afternoon, will be at Santa Maria de la Paz.
So Saturday and Sunday.
Yes. Santa Maria de la Paz Community Church is on South Richards, across from the Community College.
Yeah, right across from the Community College.
Exactly.
And both of those interesting spaces.
Yes. The Los Alamos space is smaller, but also very acoustically, very live. And then I love singing at Santa Maria de la Paz, because I think it's the one acoustic here in Santa Fe that most nearly approximates kind of a cathedral acoustic. It's very it's very live and reverberant. And it's
more so than the cathedral?
I think so.
Oh, how interesting.
I really think so.
Yeah, I've been to the cathedral and sat. What was I there for? Something where I had to sit really far away because my tickets were in the way back.
Yes.
And it was hard to hear. It was interesting.
Yes. Uh-huh.
When you're close, it's fabulous.
Right, right. No, Santa Maria de la Paz has a beautiful sound.
Now, we're talking to Doyle Preheim, musical director of the Sagrado Cristo Chorale. How did you get involved with the chorale? You've been doing this for, what, 8 or 9 years?
This is my conclusion of my 8th season as musical director. Mary Jo, my wife, and I came to Santa Fe in June of 2003. And the first year we were here, we were asked if I would like to audition for this position. And I did that in the first season. And then I was officially hired in, I think it was June of 2004, to be their musical director.
And so it's been a nice run for you.
It's been a wonderful run. We say often, my wife and I say often, this is the single most important thing that's happened to us in Santa Fe because it opened so many doors. We immediately learned to know 48 wonderful people, 50 people.
Right.
And they introduced us to their friends, many of them, of course, interested in music or the arts. And so the circle got larger and larger. So by now we feel like we know so many people here in Santa Fe and have so many connections.
So you are retiring. Do they have a new musical director?
They have appointed a new musical director. It hasn't been announced publicly, so I better not do it
here. You better not do it here.
But I think they're very fortunate to have found somebody who's very, very capable of taking them the next step, as it were.
Whom we will hope to have on the air one of these days.
I hope so. Yeah, it'd be great.
What are you going to do when you retire?
Well, I have several things that I'd like to do. Of course, we have the perennial travel list. First and foremost, spend more time with grandchildren who live in the Denver area. A trip to Costa Rica. A trip to New Zealand sometime, we hope. We came to the Southwest to explore the Southwest. We haven't done that in the last 8 years.
Right.
It's time.
I love how you come here and for the first year you explore everything and then
That's
you
right.
forget that it's there.
That's right. I also have some interest in photography and genealogy, and I want to do some family history.
Doyle Preheim, musical director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale. We will see you in Los Alamos Saturday night.
Saturday night, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
United Church. That's on Canyon Road.
Tickets in Los
available.
Alamos.
Yeah, Canyon Road on Los Alamos. In Los Alamos. Tickets available at the door. And Sunday afternoon, 2:30 at Santa Maria de la Paz.
Excellent.
Tickets available at the door. Please come.
Doyle Preheim, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Joe Trogett. He is curator of 20th century art at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. So good to be here.
Now, you have a new exhibition opening that is accompanied by this incredible book called New Mexico Art Through Time, Prehistory to the Present. Thought you'd just take a little chunk of history, meaning everything?
Well, it's a short history of New Mexico art, beginning with the first artists here in New Mexico who were the Clovis culture, Paleo-Indians who lived here 14,000 years ago, and brings us very quickly up to the present with contemporary art.
And so where did you start in putting this show together? Did you start with, let's look at the artifacts that we have?
Well, the idea was to tell the history of New Mexico art not as three cultures, but as one chronology that began a long time ago and is composed of a very complex group of cultures and aesthetic ideas that all come together and intermingle here in New Mexico and create a unique culture history.
So what are some of the oldest objects that you're showing?
Well, the oldest objects are Clovis spear points. They were made to hunt mammoths a long time ago. In reality, they're also works of art because they exhibit the most incredible kinds of flintknapping skill, and that skill goes beyond what was functionally necessary in order to make the object. And so we're presenting these objects not in multiplicity in cases, but as rarefied objects that they are. And they allow the viewer to come and really look at these objects very close up.
That's
so the exhibition at the New Mexico Museum of Art, which opens Friday, May 11th at 5 p.m., gives us a very close look at these kinds of objects in a new kind of way. These are being presented as art, not as anthropology, although they could be thought of in those kinds of ways.
Right. When you think of functional objects as works of art, it's really an invitation to the viewer to start seeing and thinking in a new way.
Absolutely. And what's so important about New Mexico art and culture is that we have an unbroken history that begins with stone tools and essentially ends up with the atomic bomb. And it's really difficult for us to get a grip on how incredible this history really is. And we have objects that may have started out to be functional objects, but when presented in the museum, the meaning changes. And the best example that I can provide is we have one of Robert Goddard's experimental rocket motors from 1931-32. And most people will see it from a distance and assume that this is just a metal sculpture. But in fact, it's both. It's a functional object, or it was a functional object, but now we see it in a whole different realm, and it really reflects the changing technology of New Mexico. It reflects a time during the 1930s when experimentation was an important part of life in New Mexico.
We're talking to Joe Troggitt about New Mexico art through time. When you talk about from spear points to the atomic bomb, you're talking about warriors through the ages from one perspective.
Well, I think that might be a sub-theme that someone could understand. But art is very much related to technology, to ecology. And this is an exhibition which makes those kinds of connections and makes the connections between aesthetic ideas and cultural ideas and explains how they come together here in a unique way.
Another sub-theme is religion, spirituality, expression of ritual.
Mm-hmm. It becomes a very complex part of this tale because there are some cultures that don't want us to be presenting their religious and spiritual ideas in public. And so we have to be cognizant of that, but other cultures feel differently. So there's important Spanish colonial religious work that is Catholic and Christian in content. But at the other end of the spectrum, we have an incredible work by Florence Miller Pierce, and she presents spirituality from a visual perspective and presents spirituality as it relates to time and place and the cycles of life.
And the reality, and this is sort of less emphasized in mid to late 20th century, but the whole notion of we're living in a desert and our lives are so much about survival and or have historically been so much about survival. And you see this in a lot of the different images, whether you're looking at a desert landscape or whether you're looking at an Indian pot and the idea of holding our relatively scarce water.
Well, water is could be a sub-theme of this as well. And certainly what's so interesting about looking way back into our culture history is that in order to survive, the first inhabitants of New Mexico, Paleo-Indians who came 140 centuries ago, had to be very cognizant of rare materials and rare resources, had to know how to follow game as they moved through the countryside. And we have to have a very warm feeling toward the knowledge that these people had. These were not primitives. These were people with a very sophisticated understanding of New Mexico, the climate, the changing seasons. This is not simple.
Right. Try putting any one of us and our immediate families out in nature for a week and see how well we do.
We would not do very well.
There are then in the mid to late 20th century up to the present whole different perspectives that are very much influenced by a much broader context for art.
That's true. This is truly an intercultural exhibition. And some of the works from the mid to late 20th century give us new insights into those kinds of relationships. So there are two self-portraits, one by T.C. Cannon, the other by Fritz Scholder. And these are very sad images, and yet the work that they created was in fact so empowering to late 20th century audiences. And I think that's one place where you can see this nexus of intercultural ideas coming together with late 20th century ideology.
Then you have some works. I was really struck by this one called Black Mesa Looking East, from a 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air. And you see Alex Harris. You see this amazing landscape, but what's really emphasized is the bright red steering wheel and dashboard panel of this automobile.
Well, I think this addresses a number of the ideas in the exhibition.
Yeah.
That you're looking at Black Mesa, which is considered a spiritual space, and yet for other people, the 57 Chevy Lowrider is a spiritual space. And it's presented in the exhibition next to Luis Tapia's version of a Spanish colonial dashboard.
Right.
And if you look carefully in the rearview mirror of the dashboard, you see that the driver is being chased by a death cart. And so it's a religious image as well.
We're talking to Joe Traugott, curator at the New Mexico Museum of Art. I think here in New Mexico, perhaps more than other places, maybe not, but there's a lot of sensitivity about people interpreting each other's cultures, even as those cultures overlap and intermingle and influence each other. And that's something that as a museum curator, you're probably having to deal with all the time.
We do. And I don't think we're really interpreting other people's cultures. What
no,
we're
but
doing,
painters are.
Well,
you know, you've got some oil paintings of Indians by your Euro-Americans and things like that.
Things change, and sensitivities change, and we don't always look back at works of art in the same way that we may have thought about them at the time that they were being created. And one of the important things about an exhibition like this is to look at art and culture from new perspectives with clear eyes and not be so seduced by color and form and think about the content as well.
What were some of the interesting moments for you in the process of putting this all together? I mean, it's a huge undertaking, and you must have had all sorts of surprises and discoveries.
Well, I've been a curator at the museum for 16 years, and when I came here, one of the artists that I was most interested in was Raymond Johnson. And I noticed in the printout of our collection that Johnson had given us two paintings that were part of a series of abstractions that were based on letter form. So there's sort of a letter form, and then it branches out into abstract forms. And Johnson, in 1936, gave us the letters M and N. And I thought, isn't that strange that he gave us two sort of unremarkable letters?
N, M.
Wow. But when you see it in alphabetical order, it takes just a little bit of time to understand that. And so after I made that revelation about 10 years ago, Johnson's two paintings become the title panel of the exhibition. So the subtitle of 14,000 Years of Art in, and then there are the two paintings, N and M, making clear the title of the work.
Do you have a couple of favorite works in this show?
Well, one of my favorites, and I know it will be a favorite of audiences, is a hand-built racing motorcycle by James Parker, who's a local industrial designer, and has a patent for a new kind of front end for a motorcycle that doesn't have the twin forks of your old bicycle, but in fact holds the front wheel from one side and eliminates a lot of the friction and the binding that you usually have with a normal motorcycle front end.
Wow.
This is really
The wheel from one side?
Yes.
That's almost scary.
Well, when you look at it from the other side, the wheel is just sitting in space because there is nothing to connect it. It's a wonderful work of art.
Joe Traugott is curator of 20th century art at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and the book that accompanies the exhibition is New Mexico Art Through Time, Prehistory to the Present, and the show itself opens this Friday.
This Friday at 5 o'clock should be a big project. It's part of the New Mexico Museum of Art's celebration of the centennial of New Mexico statehood. And the exhibition and the publication were generously supported by the New Mexico Humanities Council and Newman's own foundation. And so we wouldn't be able to bring this to the public without the wonderful support of these foundations.
Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'd like now to welcome Webster Young. He is a composer, he's a writer, and he is here to tell us about something that's happening at El Museo Cultural, which is a display of giant scenic backdrops from the Metropolitan Opera. Welcome, Webster, to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, these are from 1928 by Joseph Urban. Tell us about these backdrops. Why should people go see them? What are they?
Well, these are historic painted scenic backdrops from the old Metropolitan Opera House, and they were bought in the 1950s by an opera enthusiast when the Metropolitan Opera moved up to Lincoln Center, and nobody has anything like this. It's very difficult these days to obtain scenery that's been in production at the Metropolitan Opera.
Were they for specific operas?
Yes. Two of the drops are from the 1928 Manon, and that opera premiered with the great tenor Beniamino Gigli as the leading tenor. And another of the drops is kind of a generic ballroom drop that was used for Die Fledermaus, La Rondine, operas that need a sort of Germanic-style ballroom, Rosenkavalier.
Now, you are going to be talking about these amazing objects tomorrow night at 7:30, and these are going to be on view only on Wednesdays at El Museo, is that right?
That's right, unless we add more days at the end, which we may do.
Right. And so you will be talking about opera, about these sets, about the history of opera scenery?
I'll be talking about the provenance of the drops, which is quite an interesting story. I'll try not to give it all away here.
Okay.
But
give us a hint.
This scenery was bought by a Long Island shoemaker or shoe repairman who won the $64,000 question on television.
That's hilarious. And actually, of all the things he could have bought.
Yeah, and the incident is so well known that it was referred to in the movie Game Show, where they don't mention him by name, but they mention some of the dialogue says, even a shoemaker has won.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Now, you are going to be releasing a memoir called Berkeley Paris Express. And what's that? That's coming out in a few weeks?
Yes, at the third Wednesday we'll begin the book release. We'll have copies there, and I'll sign them.
So that's Wednesday, May 23rd.
Yes, that would be the third Wednesday we'll start having the books there.
At El Museo.
Yes.
And what's it about?
It's a memoir of studying music and painting, starting in Berkeley, California, and going to Paris, France, and then the Juilliard School. And it's mainly, it is a memoir, but it's mainly about ideas of art. And I hope that by the time someone is through reading this book, they would have an idea of how art could be more meaningful in our times.
What's the Berkeley piece of it?
Well, I first studied music at UC Berkeley in 1968, and I also met my mentor at that time, who is a painter, a brilliant expressionist painter who's never had a showing. And even to this day, he hasn't. And I have 12 of his paintings in the book. And about a third of the book is about him.
Now, it's you have you're a classical composer, but your mentor is a painter.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually I think I was fortunate because painting is easier to tell a story and to show meaningful things. Music is very abstract, and as a student, it was difficult for me to... I felt that music could have meaning, but none of my teachers believed that music could have any specific meaning. So part of my search was to understand how music has meaning.
Very interesting. And so you explore this in your memoir?
Yes.
So we're talking to Webster Young. And once again, the display of giant scenic backdrops from the Metropolitan Opera, painted in 1928 by Joseph Urban. These backdrops will be on view at El Museo Cultural here in Santa Fe on Wednesday, so tomorrow, the 9th of May, and then again the 16th, 23rd, and 30th, and then June 6th. And there's the doors open at 7 o'clock. There's a talk at 7:30, and on the third of those Wednesdays, the 23rd, Webster Young will be talking about his memoir, and it will be available for people. And there is a charge to get in, and it all benefits El Museo Cultural.
Yeah, so tomorrow is a preview. It's a lower price. And also, I should add that we're going to have costumes on display from the Old Met as well. We added that to the show because our best backdrop is still arriving.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
And when will it be here?
I think, again, in two Wednesdays.
Oh, okay. So you can pace out your Wednesdays, ladies and gentlemen, and come once or more than once. Webster Young, composer and writer, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.